After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
One last thing I'll say, that the masculine spirituality has been largely about transcendence, you know, that rising up and out and blasting off. It's a very vertical kind of energy. And the feminine is so much about embodiment and reclaiming our embodied experience as holy and our relationship with the earth and all of that. But it's really a blending that I'm speaking of, because you can't have, immanence is not anything without being infused by the spirit of transcendence. But if that's all we're after, we're going to miss the sacred possibilities in every moment of our embodied lives. Okay.
Hello, and welcome, friends, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and we hope this podcast finds you as well as can be. Here at CSM, our guide, David Nichtern, discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with our guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And what a privilege it is to get to present to you this deeply heartfelt conversation between David and this episode's amazing guest, Mirabai Starr. I will echo David's forthcoming opening statement that it's challenging to sum up Mirabai, her work, and her journey in a succinct manner. However, that is my role here, so I will set the table with a brief exposition of salient biographical details, and then we will get into the conversation. Mirabai Starr is an award-winning author of creative nonfiction and contemporary translations of sacred literature. She taught philosophy and world religions at the University of New Mexico Taos for 20 years, and now teaches and speaks internationally on contemplative practice and interspiritual dialogue. A certified bereavement counselor, Mirabai helps mourners harness the transformational power of loss and cites the connection between profound loss and longing for God as the ground of her own spiritual life. A daughter of the counterculture, an ecumenical weaver of the world's faith traditions, a devotee of Neem Karoli Baba, and a translator of mystics who loves hikes in the mountains with her family. Be sure to pick up the new edition of her book, Julian of Norwich, The Showings, coming out on April 1st with a foreword by Richard Rohr. And also head to her website, www.mirabaistar.com, to connect with her and her teaching. That's Mirabai Starr with two R's. Okay, on with the show. And now, episode number 32 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast, Fierce and Tender Wisdom with Mirabai Starr.
Okay, so welcome, friends, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. Special guest today, I'm very excited, Mirabai Starr, who is hard to contain in a single sentence or paragraph. So I think we will get the full range of your capacity as we speak more. I've been reading, listening to actually the audiobook of Wild Mercy, which is your most recent book. Already I'm completely hooked into it. And I think one of the things that I wanted to start off with is, for me, being who I am at the stage I am, this is a uniquely feminine perspective. Is that fair to say? I know that's a tricky thing to say these days. What is masculine? What's feminine? Would you characterize it as a feminine perspective?
Absolutely. I think that's very much what this is. It's all about reclaiming a kind of feminine voice and feminine wisdom across the spiritual traditions.
Wow. Sure. Okay. So great place to launch from. How would you define masculine and feminine?
Yeah, that is a good place, David. Sure. And it's changing for me all the time, which I think is part of the feminine landscape, is that it's a fluid, creative, very alive space that doesn't necessarily lend itself to fixed definitions, that this is the way masculine is and this is the way feminine is. So given that, my feminine perspective on what's feminine and what's masculine is that, first of all, both genders live in all of us, in people of all genders. Like, we all contain these energies of the masculine and the feminine. And so some of the kind of defining characteristics, I suppose, would be that masculine attributes are things like rational, logical thought, conceptual constructs as kind of fixed containers that we can rely upon. Sometimes a dissociation with feelings, because feelings, both physical, sensual feelings and also emotional feelings, can often be perceived in this domain of the masculine as being problems, predicaments, obstacles, however you might want to call impediments. And yet there is a certain power, for sure, in the kind of legalistic constructs that are built in the masculine domain. And of course, women, as much as men and people of all genders, have and live into these qualities, right? Feminine qualities, I guess, we're invoking here are things more like, yes, the more tender aspects of the feminine, like loving kindness, compassion, mercy, unconditional forgiveness, but also the fierce feminine qualities, the Kali-like qualities of truth-telling, of cutting through the bullshit to get to the truth, and being willing to abide in spaces that are subversive and seem perilous or dangerous or, out of the comfort zone. And, you know, that Dakini energy that's kind of wild and shakes it all up. So that's kind of the range of the feminine. And I've had, a lot of people, including people who identify as non-binary or queer, tell me that it's that really what I'm talking about isn't feminine, certainly isn't masculine. It's more gender fluid or even gender queer. It's about reclaiming this balance in all of us. Because the one last thing I'll say, sorry, that was a very long intro, is that the masculine spirituality has been largely about transcendence, that rising up and out and blasting off. It's a very vertical kind of energy. And the feminine is so much about embodiment and reclaiming our embodied experience as holy and our relationship with the earth and all of that. But it's really a blending that I'm speaking of, because you can't have, immanence is not anything without being infused by the spirit of transcendence. But if that's all we're after, we're going to miss the sacred possibilities in every moment of our embodied lives. Okay.
Yeah. Whether people will resonate with or not, things feel a certain way. That's the sort of interesting thing. You look at the sky, it feels a certain way. You look at a lake, it feels a certain way. Somebody touches your arm, it feels a certain way. And, it seems to me that that's, when I heard your your book and the way you're reading it, what you're talking about, beyond anything you're saying, there was a tone to it. You know, there's something we call in the music called room tone, which is a very interesting thing. It's the sound the room makes when nothing is happening in the room. Huh. It's just, and actually when you do record a voice, like a voiceover, like for your book, they have to match the room tone. If you do an overdub and it doesn't match the room tone, you'll hear it like hush, hush, like little subtle shift in the background noise. It's very subtle, but it's detectable. Yeah,
that's fascinating.
So what's the room tone when you walk in? What's the vibe? You know, what's the atmosphere? And you know, I teach a lot in Japan, and they talk a lot about atmosphere. That things have a certain atmosphere. That's the feeling I'm getting from hearing you talk about it. There's a certain non-fungible, non-linear, maybe challenging to describe other than through more poetic means, delineation of parsing the different aspects of being a human being.
Yes. And I think for me personally, not only is it the feminine, definitely the terrain of feeling as you're describing, but also I think I'm a frustrated musician. You know, I love to sing. I've always loved, been drawn to music, but I've never become I don't have what it takes to become a professional musician, but I think my musicality informs my writing. I just can't bear tedious, pedantic, left brain Dharma books.
Yeah.
Beautiful. The transmission is beautiful. Mm. And if the container for the transmission is not also beautiful, I think we can so easily miss the more transformative energy of whatever the Dharma teaching may be.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been studying in our Dharma Moon Tuesday night gathering the Heart Sutra for the last 6 weeks. Which is sometimes called the Heart Attack Sutra. Did you know that?
No. Why?
Never heard that? There's a reason. The reason is that it's so profoundly rug-pulling and sort of cutting through any kind of conceptual mind that supposedly when the Buddha presided over that discourse, the arhats, several of the arhats, kind of quite realized people at the level of individual realization, felt the ground pulled out from them so much so that literally they died of heart attacks.
Wow. What a legend.
Yeah. That's isn't that a great story. So I call it the Heart Attack Sutra, you know, in honor of Billy Joel. But, you know, in trying to wrap your mind around it, what happens is that something that's so well covered in the tantric teachings, which is you can't just conceptualize these things. They're going to talk to a different part of your whole state of mind. But in time, trying to grasp onto it, you're going to be, the more you study the Heart Sutra, the more frustrated you're going to get, which is what's been happening. We're in week six tonight, later tonight.
Wow.
And, you know, people are having less and less of a good time going, I get it. because the thing to get is that you don't get it. And what's also interesting is that Buddha didn't teach it, actually. He's presiding, and two of Shariputra, who's sort of like inquiring, asked Avalokiteshvara, who's, you know, sort of non-binary in a certain way, how should we practice this? And Buddha is like a lot of these times just sitting there in some kind of meditative equipoise. And at the end, he just says, good job, fellas, you know, like something like that, you know. So this unplugging or unpulling, pulling out the rug, I associate that with feminine energy. Yeah. And, you know, it's easy to get in trouble these days when you characterize these things. Yeah. So I'm going to ask everybody out there to forgive me in advance if I misspeak about how some of these things are spoken about. In the current vernacular, I'm not meaning to cause anybody any discomfort that way. But I associate that in my life with the feminine principle, where you don't quite know where you stand.
Yes. Exactly. And David, you know, two quick responses. One is, yes, the feminine is about mystery. It's about the holiness of not knowing, not a problem to be solved, but a reality to be entered. But also the fact that we're talking about it at all, and that you're a white dude interviewing or in dialogue with someone like me, affirming the primacy of the feminine voice and feminine wisdom is everything. It means everything. So I appreciate your apology, but I also want to bow to you for doing the work that men especially need to do, but all of us need to do, to just shift the paradigm of all the spiritual teachings that we've received that we love so much being really exclusively rooted in a masculine mindset. And we're just trying to shift that for the benefit of all beings, not just women.
Well, and on that note, I just, you know, one could, you know, I used to compose music for daytime television quite a while back.
I knew that about you.
Yeah. I did the music for One Life to Live, and As the World Turns, which I used to call As the Nick Turns, just as a little in-house joke. And my producers were women. The shows were organized around getting a largely female audience. One of my producers, Linda Gottlieb, who produced that movie Dirty Dancing and then went on to produce One Life to Live, she said our audience is 90% women. And the other 10% we don't really care about, you know. In other words, they were zoning into a particular audience that was, you know, supporting the show. But I want to make this statement ahead of time. In case you think, my friends out there, that this book and this perspective, oh, you know, yeah, I'll just listen to it a little bit. You should read this book, Wild Mercy. You know, the perspective will expand your horizons in terms of getting a real transmission about what Mirabai is talking about here. So I just want to, and that's not a plug. That's really like a heartfelt sentiment of, and it's not even like a catch up with the program kind of thing. It's like enter a certain space that you'll find intoxicating and really it's refreshing, because a lot of Dharma books are, as you said, kind of flat, kind of square, kind of nerdy. And, you know, you have also, it's fair to say, you've studied a lot of different traditions. You're wildly eclectic, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. I came by that honestly, but kind of growing up around Lama Foundation.
So your parents, am I getting that right? Your parents were practitioners?
No, and yes and no. I mean, my parents were definitely counterculture people. So I lived my first 11 years in New York, Long Island. They were, you know, non-religious, kind of anti-religious Jews from New York. And as part of the Vietnam era and their work as social justice activists, peace activists, they ended up uprooting us from suburban life. And it was part of that period when a lot of early hippie families were hitting the road, you know, just in caravans. And that's what we did. So we traveled around, and Be Here Now had just come out. And that was one of the counterculture beacons. And that's what brought us to New Mexico. And we went straight to Lama Foundation, and my parents were like, nah, too religious.
And how old were you at that point?
I was 11, just turning 12.
Oh, my goodness. And brothers and sisters in the caravan?
Yeah. In fact, part of what really uprooted us, I think, from New York is that our older brother, Maddie, had died of a brain tumor when he was 10. And I was 7, and my sister was 4, and my youngest brother was newborn. So I think, you know, so often in a family, the death of a child especially is so, it's such a disruption of everything, destabilizing the whole structure, which was ready to give anyway because of what was happening in the culture, you know, questioning things like the nuclear family and all of those norms. So It was so my brother's death really was the catalyst for something going all the way that was starting to go anyway. And yes, so we all traveled and we didn't go to school, obviously. And we lived a lot of that time on a very remote beach in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico.
Wow.
Now covered with high rises that are like $1,200 a night. But at the time it was, we slept on the beach and ate fish and rice. It was very, very, it was instrumental in my parents' entire kind of cultural and spiritual awakening, but they just didn't identify with a particular spiritual path. But Lama, because of our proximity, they settled in Taos, which is just down the road from Lama, which is where we still all are, you know, four generations of us now. But
Meaning your parents are there too?
Yeah, parents, my siblings and I, our children, and now our grandchildren. Yeah.
Wow.
So, but they did, but Lama was very connected to the Taos community, well, at least the counterculture part of the Taos community in the 70s. And I ended up spending a lot of time at Lama and then moving up when I was 15. I met Neem Karoli Baba, not in the body, but in fact, it was just the year after he left his body that I became a devotee.
What year would that be?
75.
75. He passed away.
73. Say no. 73 was when he left his body. I think 73.
You would know better than I.
I can't remember which year it was, but anyway, it had been very recent.
Right.
I met Ram Dass at Lama, and that's when I.
And was Ram Dass a teacher of yours at that point? A major central character.
Central
of course.
Character.
For those who don't know, I met Mirabai in Maui at the, the Ram Dass and Krishna Dass retreats, and myself in the capacity of a guitar player, I sometimes call it my day job. Teaching versus my night job. But, Mirabai has been often a presenter there. And so you're really integrally tied in with that community then for many, many years.
Yes, but I was invisible by design for many of those years. It was only after I started having books published that I feel like my own spiritual family said, "Oh, I didn't know you did that."
Wow. By design, invisible by design. Could that be the next book?
Oh my God. I think that's what we're trying to deconstruct here is the way that we've been conditioned by these patriarchal religions to disappear, that the ego is bad, that all of these personality issues that we carry around, personalities that we tote around are somehow unspiritual. So yes, I think that it's time for us all to stand up in what is ours to do and be and give in these times.
You know, I'm a songwriter, and "Invisible by Design" is a hooky title.
Okay, if I don't use it for a book, I think you should use it for a song.
No, I mean, it's yours. It came up and for you. So, Ram Dass comes to mind as as most people out there know, you know, Ram Dass passed away right before the pandemic, got out while the getting was good, we were all, I think you were there that year, right? We were there all together, or were you not there that year?
I was not there the year that he died. Yeah. I got to see him when he came to Taos for the consecration.
Right.
Hanumanta.
Right. Yeah, he went to right before that. He was... And during that, we all, of course, had many times when we said, gee, I think this could be the last time we get to gather to do this. And of course, he kept faking us all out. But that year, shortly after that, I think really several weeks after that Maui retreat in early December, he passed away.
Yeah.
I'd have to say stunningly from my perception of watching a lot of lamas pass and so forth is that he seemed extremely... at ease, I would say, is what comes to mind with the transition, with letting go. And he also, I had a long history with him that was kind of intriguing because I studied with Trungpa Rinpoche. And of course, Ram Dass and Trungpa Rinpoche had a whole dance going on at Naropa Institute back in 1974. So he and I would sometimes kid around about those days, you know, and the difference between, but I'm trying to explain to people that was the Wild West as far as spirituality in the West goes. And there was a lot of different things sort of coming together, Zen teachers and, you know, and now, you know, you can now on Google, you can find out whatever you need to know about Mahamudra or Dzogchen or esoteric Hindu teachings, you know. So, and then I just saw USA Today had an article about the 10 top meditation teachers, like in 2022. And I thought, well, there's going to be award ceremonies next. It's crazy. But Ram Dass is singular in that he launched, assisted, supported, inspired, gave kindling and firewood to so many people. It's almost startling. And he was would you say he was like of all the influences that you had, was he paramount?
Yes, I would definitely say that. But it took me until almost, you know, the day he died to admit it. I had been really burned, David, by a lot of spiritual teachers. You know, a lot of bullshit had been heaped upon me as a young aspirant, you know, as this teenager on fire with desire for God. And so I was just like a prime target for a lot of fakes. And Ram Dass also never claimed to be an awakened master. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, as well as my innate skepticism bordering on cynicism, I didn't really let him in all the way. I mean, I let it, as a beloved, he was all the way in. Mm-hmm. Ram Dass was always dear to me. I called him Uncle Ram Dass because he was the same age as my parents. And he was very kind of avuncular with me in the sense that he was very proud of me for my books. And he, you know, would check on me to see what I was up to. It was always a feeling of family tenderness, but it was, and I always called him my elder guru brother, mm-hmm. because we had the same guru. So sure. It really took me a while to actually admit that not only has he been my lifelong teacher since I was 15, but that the way I am as a teacher is entirely formed, shaped by Ram Dass, you know, everything about what I teach, the way I teach, the way I draw on all these different spiritual traditions and sacred scriptures, all of that.
Wow. I feel like I'm channeling him saying wow right now. The way he's just saying, wow. You know, you referred to and you talked about in your book, and what you just referred to in this last section here, that you did experience charlatanism and, you know, you were open and you were aspiring and that you had been taken advantage of. I think that's a powerful, powerful story to share. I don't know what parts of it you want to share or don't want to share, but I know it's an important thread for people these days to understand the difference between devotion and exploitation.
Yeah.
You seem to have a lot to offer about it.
Thank you, David. Well, you know, I'm in thinking about it. Okay, so friends, what David's referring to is that one of my early spiritual teachers was definitely not a realized being in any sense of the word. And he sexually abused me as part of my curriculum for awakening. It sounds so cliche now, but at the time it felt so profound. I was 15. It was the same year I met Ram Dass and became a devotee of Neem Karoli Baba and also a Sufi and also developed my Buddhist practice, you know, which is basically a Vipassana practice. And so I'm realizing as I get older, I just turned 60, that it was the times too. And that's not to excuse what happened. I mean, the guy who abused me was a creepy, disgusting human being. He's gone now. He's no longer alive. And I feel freer. But it was also teenage girls were sleeping with older guys, like it, at Llama, everywhere I went, you know, it was very common. And yet what was disgusting about it was that, A, this man told me that it was that in order to have my spiritual awakening, which I longed for so much, that this was part of it, and B, that it had to be secret. So that was the difference between me and some of my peers, you know, who were having open relationships with older men as part of the whole countercultural, what are we doing now as human beings, you know, and in society, in relationship, in community, how do we do this now with the with everything shifting? So, yeah, the part, the secret part was really wrong. And there were a lot of things that were really, really wrong, especially because the emphasis on the spiritual practices in the spiritual practices was very much on transcending the body. And it, and that left me vulnerable for my body to be exploited. And I'm afraid some of the rest of you who are hearing this are going, yep, that happened to me too. Me too. So it's taken me a long time, decades, to come to peace with it. And if I can help younger women in any way, or men who are finding that have found themselves in similar situations, I feel like that's, you know, that's always the gift, right, of any of our suffering, is that we can hopefully help other people as they suffer.
Yeah. Well, you know, also you, what you've been through has created the fabric of who you are now.
Absolutely.
And you're clearly a wise person, and wisdom is, you know, get a quick, oh, give me the weekend course on wisdom. I told Daniel Aiken, my publisher at Wisdom, I said, I've got a great idea for a book for us. Wisdom for Dummies. How about that?
People would pay a lot of money for that.
You know, so it's not, you know, I also used to play with this guy, David Bromberg, who had a song called You Have to Suffer If You Want to Sing the Blues, which would make me laugh every single time. It's not that. It's just that, you know, the depth of perspective you get from having actually dared to live and actually engaged living at the time on its own terms. Those are the people who actually do have something deeper to communicate, because they engaged, they entered the action. They were in the flow. So I do think you would have, I'm sure you do have a lot to say to the current crop of acolytes and aspirants. And I, since I teach a lot with young people, and so, you know, our Dharma Moon crowd is like a lot of 20s and 30s people.
Wow,
and for whatever reason, I'm very comfortable with that, that somehow the combination of the music and also the culture seems like it's gone a full cycle. So there's something about the way they hang out that reminds me, you know, of us at a certain stage. And also there is a communal energy, and there's also a lack of wanting to define yourself in a concrete way. So I call them the hyphenates, the hyphenate generation. They'll say, I'm a producer, writer, carpenter, painter, and the hyphens seem to be part of the way of self-defining right now, more than I've ever seen before.
I love
so,
that.
You know, then there's just wanting to be really sure that they're not, that you're not assuming anything, you know, because the wheel does go around. And I think of it as a Ferris wheel. You don't really get to go around again in this life. You know, at a certain point, you're over here and you should take a certain seat of, you know, I'm a grandpa now, you know, it's you sit in the playground, you watch the kids play, you know, you're not jumping around as much. So, but you seem to be uniquely, I wondered how do you go about presenting to folks these days? Are you doing workshops, trainings, online things? What's your life like in that regard as a presenter?
Well, prior to the pandemic, I was traveling at least 50% of the time. It felt like a lot more because, you know, there's all the recovering from traveling. So I was doing a lot of workshops and retreats. On, you know, my most current theme from my book, Wild Mercy, was reclaiming women's wisdom across the spiritual traditions. You're right, I'm a very eclectic kind of being, and I've deeply studied but also practiced in multiple religious and spiritual, you know, landscapes. So it was a lot of women's wisdom across the spiritual traditions, and I blend poetry of the mystics and writing ourselves and art making and music and chanting with meditation, and then teachings of the mystics that I love. Like, for instance, I'm a translator of the Spanish mystics, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila. These are medieval, not medieval, 16th century Catholic saints.
And she in particular, you mentioned in your book, is an archetype for you, right? She's
totally, yeah. Yes.
And what was her main character that you identify with?
She was definitely subversive. She single-handedly led a major reform movement in the Catholic Church in her time and was persecuted for it. She also was Jewish by birth. She came from a converso family, a Jewish family forced by the Inquisition to convert to Catholicism during that era. She was born in 1515, so Spain had taken over, I mean, the Catholic Church had taken over Spain in 1492 when they expelled Jews and Muslims, who had been living, by the way, in relative harmony in Spain, Jews, Muslims, and Christians for 800 years at that point.
Well, isn't that exactly the year that Columbus landed in?
Sailed the ocean blue, 1492, yes.
That's interestingly synchronous. So you were teaching workshops based on her?
Her and other mystics, but she's kind of my girl. You know, having translated her, it's like living with a guru, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like having darshan every day.
Wow.
And receiving that direct transmission. Translating is one of the most powerful spiritual experiences I've ever had.
You're translating from Spanish into English?
Yeah, from Spanish, right. And it was, you know, it wasn't modern Spanish, conversational mm-hmm. Spanish. It was late Renaissance Spanish, so it was challenging to translate Teresa and John of the Cross. I also translated Dark Night of the Soul, John of the Cross's kind of mystical masterwork, and some of his poetry. In fact, Ram Dass and Ramesh Das asked me to translate one of St. John of the Cross's poems for one of their books. I think it was Being Love, right? No, I forgot which one. Anyway, so that's the only place that translation exists right now. So these workshops just blended wisdom teachings with practice, with meditation practice, chanting, silence, and writing, because writing is a profound spiritual practice for me. And so people seem to really respond to this basket that we weave of various modalities. So it wasn't just lecture and meditating, you know, mm-hmm. it was poetry, it was heart awakening kinds of experiences, and a lot of dialogue, community creation, where this is the kind of invisible I do appreciate, where I can kind of disappear and they create community mm-hmm. with themselves and each other. And that's such a beautiful and seemingly rare experience, that kind of community building of Sangha that happens when we come together in these ways. So now I'm doing a lot of that online for various organizations. I'm teaching with Andrew Harvey, a year-long course right now that we call Global Mystics, and a lot of things like that. And I'm writing, you know, I'm continuing to write. So teaching and writing. And now I'm beginning to travel again. And it's all of a sudden my calendar 2022 is completely filled to the gills. I don't know how
to travel, to physically travel.
A lot of traveling.
You know, I had dinner with Ramesh and Kate Friday night. I'm out in East Hampton right now. And, I looked at them and I really haven't been seeing a lot of people physically. And I went, where's your box? Where's your square?
You have legs.
I walked around behind them. You know, this has been, and I really did feel, frankly, like I was tripping. There was a vividness to it that was like, you know, I mean, since we have crossed those bridges, you can adapt to that feeling, but it wasn't just kind of, it didn't. So I don't know if you're, when you get out and about, it'll be interesting to see how that feels. Have you done anything in traveling yet?
Maui with you guys.
That was a little weird, right?
It was a little weird. And we were still masked and, you know, maybe we'll be. I also taught a women's retreat on Molokai right before that. And that was really beautiful just to be. That was my first in-person experience. And then Maui was wonderful. And I feel ready. I just don't want to get back to the life that I was living, which was really dissipating.
Right. Me.
And as a writer, I really need fallow time. I need to just be home. I need to walk in these mountains. I'm looking out my window right now. It's a snowstorm coming. And I walk every day in the mountains. And that's essential for everything that I am and do. Mm.
Now, you've heard of the wish-fulfilling jewel, right?
Yes.
So sometimes kidding around the wish-fulfilling Jew, you know. the wish-fulfilling Jew, let's say you had access.
Mm.
Okay. And you know, without any reserve and projecting forward, because, you know, I mean, you might take a very, very exotic position, say, I'd like to change the past, which they say certain adepts can actually do that 7 generations back, but I haven't really experienced that one yet. But going forward, you know, is there something you would like to manifest that would just be complete fruition for you?
Personally?
Well, you know, I'm not even going to characterize.
Okay, my sense, my very strong sense, David, is that these tumultuous times are a very creative, generative, fruitful time that is both killing, dying, crucifying the things that need to go, the structures that need to collapse are collapsing. And what this gives us is that collectively is this opportunity, and not the only one who's saying this, many of us are saying this, to co-create consciously the world that we want to see and live in together. And so my dream, my wish for that wish-fulfilling tree is that we can step up in the middle of the fire of change and seeming destruction right now, the catastrophe, the cataclysm, the apocalypse, and together say yes to what works, say no to what needs to go, and co-create this new world that is grounded in loving kindness, compassion, creativity, and all of the things that give life and honor life and honor our interconnectedness, this web of interbeing, as Tai called it, to which we all belong, that become our lived reality. And I, for one, am excited about participating in it. If I survive, I want to be a space of tenderness and strength and equanimity and fun and support for others going forward, because I've done my work. I mean, I want to have done my work. Maybe by then I will have started doing whatever the real work is that will help enable me to be a source of some kind of strength for others.
That's quite an aspiration. And
a little lofty, you'll have to forgive me. Bordering on grandiose, I suppose.
I didn't take it that way. No, because your feet never left the ground when you were saying it, you know. Didn't seem to. Makes me want to pause, actually.
I want to know what yours is.
You know, in our tradition, we say first thought, best thought. That's something that Trungpa Rinpoche used to say quite a lot. First thought, best thought. And then it had a second. The first one was to finish. Not completely sure what that meant. And then the second word came to finish gracefully. So for me personally, there are certain projects that I want to complete. Mm-hmm. Some are creative. I've had the hybrid life of the creative and the, you know, the Dharma have really cohabited in one life, sometimes vying and sometimes collaborating. So I have two musicals that I've almost completely written. I would love to see them actually get done.
Wow.
I have a new album coming out called Pandemonia, which was inspired by the this little 2 years that we just lived through. Mm. And then on the Dharma side, spontaneously during the same 2 years you're talking about, we created this platform called Dharma Moon. And Dharma Moon is quite residual from a previous perception and has to do with the work that I did with Trungpa Rinpoche, but sprouts out from it too. And the sort of, if you want to get a caption, it's when the sun of Dharma shines, the moon of Dharma reflects all that brilliance. Mm. And so it is feminine. It is art. It is culture. A lot of the people in our community are artists and musicians. Don't have to be. You just have to be artful and lyrical in how you, because that's how we often express it. And the idea would be that there could be a real integration, which is why creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. There could be real integration, not some, necessarily some CEO with the malas around the, the wrist going to do ayahuasca ceremony on their Christmas break. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I mean, real integration where those things are not really thought of as antithetical, because my whole life I watched the spiritual community withdraw, pull back from the world of engagement.
Exactly.
And then we see, you know, people who are really successful in the world, becoming, let's say detached, energetically, emotionally from the creation that's going on. So, and this is something that, you know, you could say, I got this from Trungpa Rinpoche, the vision that he had, but it's not like that. It's like it cohabited and I recognized it in him and it was more like that's what drew us together. Mm-hmm. But he also gave some teachings that were so seminal in this regard about how to create these kind of situations. So that's another thing I'm following through very much the way that, you know, our friends and you all with Maharaji, I'm following through my guru's vision even present, energetic of like, yeah, we want to actually do this. You know, we want to actually, just what you said, actually, you want to see this land. You want to see the spaceship land. That's what you just said. You'd like to see all these possibilities really manifest. So I think we have the same dream. That's the short story.
Beautiful.
Essentially, in essence. But and mine is very feminine.
Yeah.
I hang around a lot. Like our team is very, very much women. I hired a guy and first one, I think, in the core team. it's tough. Yeah, I like what you said earlier about women. It's wrathful and tough at the same time as it's nurturing and gentle. And the other thing is that, you know, I was wondering if you had ever heard the saying, Prajna Paramita, about Prajna is the mother of all the Buddhas. Have you ever heard that?
Of course. I love that. I often speak about that.
So I tell students, hey, if you want to meet Buddha's mommy, it's Prajna. You better be sharp. You better be on your toes. It's not gooey, like I love you. You know, I mean, it's just the development of acuity, discernment, unique perspective is all okay. Just like you're saying, that's okay for somebody to have their individuality, just to be sharp and to be clear, and that opens the gateway in a way just as much as devotion would.
Exactly. Yes.
So yeah, I don't know if I went on too long there, but that's.
Listen, yeah. I've been interviewed hundreds of times, and I am much more interested in you than I am in myself.
That makes two of us.
And I'm much more interested in having a conversation with an interesting person than to just hear myself talk. So I love hearing what's on your heart. And yes, you're right. There's a lot of resonance.
And podcast format, I think Duncan Trussell is my podcast guru in a way, because I didn't even know what a podcast was. And then, you know, at Maui, I went on his and I went on Pete Holmes and I went, oh, this is a kind of like a jam. It's a jam
session.
Actually,
I've been on both of theirs as well. And it's just something of the most fun I've ever had.
Yeah.
Although you're right up there with them, David, right now.
I'm not as funny as Duncan, that's for sure.
Oh, you're funny.
Yeah.
And my interview with Duncan was a little more serious, I think.
What did you talk about?
Well, Wild Mercy had just come out, and I think I was a bit fierce at that stage of things, you know, in wrestling the feminine out of the grasp of the patriarchy. So I was a bit more on a mission, and Duncan was hugely respectful of that mission.
Yeah. He's a gem.
Yes, he is.
We have regular Dharma hang on the phone, and he comes he comes by, and a lot of his friends that we have, a mindfulness meditation teacher training program three times a year, and a lot of his friends come by and actually take that. It's a 100-hour course.
Wow!
And he has a tribe. You know, there's a certain frequency there that I recognize. That we call them the Dunkites.
Yes, you know? Yeah, that's great.
What's the rest of your life like? Do you mind whatever you feel like sharing? Into any sports, any activities, art forms?
Yeah, well, we have a lot of family. You know, we have this, Gangaras and I, my husband Gangaras and I both have a lot of family here in Taos. So a lot of our life is about that. Where our youngest daughter is about to give birth next month in our bed. Yeah. So last night they were here with the midwives for 2 hours, just checking out the space and doing another prenatal exam. It's very exciting. We had a baby shower here the other day. We have between us, Gangaras and I had five girls. He had three and I had two. And my youngest daughter, Jenny, died when she was 14 in a car accident. Yeah. She grew up here at the Hanuman Temple. You know, the Neem Karoli Baba Ashram and Hanuman Temple are here in Taos. Mm-hmm. So Gangaras and I both raised our families here. In fact, that's how we met, was our youngest daughters were best friends. And we blended our two groups of girls. But so family, you know, both grappling with Jenny's death and just this new life that is continuing to unfold. Every one of the four remaining girls has now had a child. Well, Kali's about to have her first, our youngest. And so that's a lot of my life. And
you're a grandma.
I'm a grandma, about to be for the eighth time, yes. and my grandchildren are definitely a big part of my life, and I make art with them, and I take them hiking. So I also hike walk in the mountains. Just happens to be steep, so it's hiking every day, as I said. Wow. So being outdoors is a huge part of my life, and then of course writing, and I love singing in kirtan and music, sacred music of any kind. All music is sacred to me, just as all poetry is mystical poetry to me.
And you write poetry too, right?
Yeah.
I was a little hesitant.
Well, I rarely would call myself a poet, but because my prose is, as you've noticed, lyrical.
Yeah.
And so it's a fine line in some cases with my writing between poetry and prose. But yes, I'm definitely a poet as well.
Yeah. That sounds like a very rich and, you know, so positive. It's like, it's, you know, you have such a positive vibration. It's almost mood altering.
Well, thank you, David. And it comes back to that first thing we said, like about the sexual abuse, that these difficult experiences of our lives, you know, are what weave the tapestry of who we are. And I have to say that my daughter's death, which was exactly 20 years ago, was absolutely the most instrumental experience of my life, my inner and outer life. Jenny's life and death remade me and opened me to a space of wonder and joy, childlike wonder. That I think I always had that inclination, but it wasn't in spite of, but rather through the gateway of her most horrific experience I could ever imagine. Unendurable anguish, losing a child. And yet here we are. And, you know, it is 20 years later. It took me a very long time to get to the point where I could affirm life again. And yet, yes, as you say, there is a joy and sweetness and goodness, like a wholesome yumminess to my life now that is because I was galvanized in that fire.
And you know who comes to mind, just not out of the blue, but I think it's Sidima just came into my mind as a kind of energy. And for those who don't know, that was one of Maharaji's Maas. Is that a fair way to say it? How would you talk about who she is?
Well, yes, the Maas were the women that were absolutely, utterly devoted to Maharaji and took care of him. But also Sidima, as you say, was one of the most essential in Maharaji's circle of Maas, and the one to whom he really gave the task of taking care of the Westerners.
Specifically the Westerners?
Yeah, well, no, actually wrong. All his devotees.
Now, in Buddhism, we say she was possibly like a lineage holder. That's how I...
Yeah, I
see. Would that be fair to say? Or
I see her that way, too. You know, there's this new film in Be Here Now Network that's about to come out called Brilliant Disguise about Mr. Tiwari, Casey Tiwari. And in many ways, he also was that kind of lineage holder, as was KK Shah. But yes, I had the great good fortune of being with Sidima, and she was hugely helpful to me, in fact, in integrating the death of my daughter.
You personally discussed it with her?
Yes, at the time from afar, and then a few years later there in person. In fact, the epilogue of my memoir, Caravan of No Despair, is about that encounter with Sidima and how she helped me transform through this. Yeah, so you have it right there. So it's only a few pages, and if anyone's interested in Sidima, I think there's a very essential Sidima story in there. So yes, she's exceedingly dear to me and a deep, powerful teacher on my way. And it's so important for me to have women teachers, because almost all my teachers have been men.
Yeah, she seems to have a powerful role to play in quite a few of the people in your community, in that community. It's an interesting thing to... There are people who go, I got direct transmission from Jesus Christ or whatever, you know, so people who aren't there physically. And many people say that about Maharaji, for example. And actually somebody like Trungpa Rinpoche or Karmapa, they say I remember a woman artist actually back, 30 years ago, she drew a painting of Trungpa Rinpoche before she had ever seen him. And it was a likeness, you know, so it's, there's some element of like an imprint, like, you know, when you look at a very bright thing and you close your eyes, you still sort of see it.
Yes.
But I wonder, would you say you talk to Maharaji or Sidima internally, obviously, not necessarily out loud, as if they were there?
Yes, both
of
them.
You know what I'm referring to?
Yes, both of them.
Not delusional, not thinking, they're really, in the other room or something like that, but some kind of internal dialogue.
Absolutely. And I love what Ram Dass would say about that. Remember,
I don't remember what he said.
Okay, so Ram Dass often talked about this, this was post-stroke that he talked about this, that he was interviewed once and the guy said, do you talk to your guru? And Ram Dass said, yes, all the time. And he said, do you actually think that you're talking to him and he's talking back. And Ramdas said, yes, it's definitely an intimate, real dialogue between us. And the guy says, isn't that just in your imagination? And Ramdas laughed and he said, of course. That's what the imagination is for. This is a great gift of the imagination. Is it's a field where I can meet my beloved.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel too. That's exactly how I feel. I don't think of the imagination as being something other than reality. It's a place where I can meet reality.
It's so interesting to be kind of cousin to that Sangha, which is how I feel about it, you know, because of my relationship with KD, that I, you know, produces records and play guitar, and then we hang out endlessly at times, you know, that I would ask Maharaji for something before I would ask Drunkpa Rinpoche. It's like asking your uncle before you'd ask your dad.
Oh, that's great, David. I love that.
Because your dad might say, you know, more than you wanted to hear back. Your uncle says, oh, sure, have a cookie, you know. There was one thing that happened. I told this story before, and I'll just tell it very briefly, where I was producing, I think it was Kirtan Wallet, and we had to shorten the songs. We had too much music. And I didn't want to deal with it because those songs go on forever, as you know, the kirtans, and they change tempo. So it's tricky. So I said, look, and I did this in my inner mind, you know, and I have a vivid memory of it, but I couldn't really tell you when and where I actually said it, but it was clear. I said, Maharaji, it's me, David. I work with your boy, KD. You know, I've heard people ask you for stuff, so I don't want to ask you for anything big because I know you got a full docket, and I'm not one of the, you know, I'm not one of the inner gang. But here's what I'd like to ask: can you keep track of the timing on this record for me? And it's got to be 74 minutes and 30 seconds because that's all you can fit onto a CD. And then I just produced it. You know, so let's fade here. Let's cut into this one here. We had about 90 minutes of music. Then it was in Pro Tools, and Jay Messina, the engineer, we did all the edits. And then I said, okay, how long is it? 74 minutes and 30 seconds.
No way.
And that's such, I'm not like the kind of person who's going around with the Book of Miracles.
Right.
You can tell that. Yeah, I grew up in Stuyvesant Town, Manhattan. Yeah.
Oh, my
and
God.
It's like, you're talking to me, you know, so. It was a minor incident in a way, but now that I'm thinking about it, it's pretty quirky. And I know people have asked for more significant things, like could you align me with my true purpose, or you know, remove obstacles, or so. So there is, and I also know what happens to people when they pursue that perspective on, you know, how quickly that can go south on you. But that did actually happen.
I love it. And it's not a small thing because you as a producer are producing a doorway to the transformation of consciousness. So it's a huge thing. And for you to be able to relax and just do your best David thing, trusting.
Yeah. In retrospect, I can't really tell you what I knew or didn't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do feel, I did feel a strong gut reaction to Maharaji's presence, as I had to filter it through Ramdas, filter through KD, filter through all the different people, because then they're adding their filter to it. But it felt like beyond that, there was some real big power source there.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something which, you know, coming back to the feminine, I don't know, I associate it with maybe not the neurotic, toxic masculine of having to be a boss and having to know what's going on and you know, have things lined up and, you know, the law and order of it all. Just opening to the mystery. And I think you of all the people I've met lately, you really, to me, you represent that. You really do. I could see you really, really, what a beautiful offering.
Thank you so much. It's because you are so receptive that I feel like I can reveal a little bit of what I love most.
And I bet there's an, you know, we talk about outer, inner, and secret, you know, in the Buddhist tradition. So can men come to your workshops, or is it only women?
No, absolutely. I mean, I did for the first couple of years since Wild Mercy's been out for a couple of years, there was a strong emphasis on gathering women because women need it.
Right.
We need it so much. We need these spaces and we need to work together on shifting the larger paradigm. But now I am opening back up and I cherish having men in my, in fact, not enough men come to my gatherings anyway, even before this. So I would love to have more men. And my new book, the book I'm working on now is nominally called Ordinary Mysticism. And that's really about reclaiming everything we've been talking about, the landscape of our everyday lives as sacred. And so I think that my work is opening back up to people of all genders. But it's really important to, you know, people say to me, aren't you worried about getting out of balance by emphasizing the feminine? And my answer is no, nope. The imbalance is so extreme from thousands of years of patriarchal dominance that it's going to take a real effort on behalf of people of all genders to shift that.
Yeah. And obviously there's a lot of exploration, parsing, language, history. Some of the women who work in my in Dharma Moon are catching me up pretty quickly on the kind of now line of where these things fall. And I want to be a student, till the day I die, but particularly this aspect of cultural realignment and the fact that Dharma Moon is really trying to represent the graceful, reflective surface of something, not just staring at the sun till you're blind, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is the moon. And that's actually, here's the funny twist. My Buddhist refuge name was Moon of Dharma Treasure.
Wow.
In Tibetan, Dawa Chudzu. So, when I thought of Dharma Moon, it was first for my record label. And I thought it would be the perfect, so we just used it for this. So it's just the perfect name for it. So you must come to Dharma Moon. I'd like, maybe would you come into a webinar or something like that with us?
I would love to.
Yeah, and meet some of the folks. And this was... if this is all I had to do all day long, I'd be a happy camper. So thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you too, David. And thank you all for your loving attention.
Is there anything you want to leave people with? Something coming up soon? Something you want to share? Is there anything you want to leave the folks with?
Oh, thank you for asking. Ram Dass ruined me with Be Here Now. I'm just totally 100% here with you right now. And I can't even remember the rest of my life. But if people want to go to my website, mirabaistar.com, it's all there.
Right.
Follow me on Instagram. I'm pretty active on social media.
And I told you before we started that I have a song that I'm working on for you, which is Bye Bye Mirabai, Bye Bye. It'll be a swing, kind of pretty hot swing tune, pretty fast tempo. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be hopefully chatting again in the near future.
Thank you, my brother. It was a joy. Bye.
And it was a joy. Thank you, Mirabai and David, for such a beautiful conversation and for sharing it with us. The atmosphere of heart and clarity really emanated through this conversation in the moment, and regardless of what medium you were engaging with this podcast in, I'm sure you all could feel it as well. I know I'll carry it with me in my own heart mind as an embodiment of the qualities cultivated through a life of authenticity, practice, and showing up to one's experience with bravery and tenderness. And now, in conclusion, a series of links and thank yous. Thank you, Mirabai, for joining us. And thank you, Willow, for helping to coordinate this podcast. Also, I neglected to mention Instagram in the opening monologue, and Mirabai is quite active there, so please give her a follow, and you can do so by searching her name. Thank you, Corey, Sarah, JR, and everyone at the Be Here Now Network for their dedication to continuing the teachings of Ram Dass and to releasing an amazing and ever-growing archive of podcasts grounded in the world's wisdom traditions. please head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com to check out all the amazing offerings and add a /David for all the CSM pods. Thank you, David, for teaching. And if you would like to study with David and connect with us in community, head over to dharmamoon.com. These podcasts are evergreen, and we have many offerings running on our event page. If you're listening while this is fresh, David has a creativity, spirituality, and making a buck weekend program coming up soon. The course is based around David's CSM book, Which is Great. I wrote Which is Great in all caps in my script. Because it's that good. Pick up a copy on Wisdom Publications and get to work with the right amount of effort and relaxation. We also have part two of Ethan Nickturn's year-long Buddhist study course starting soon, entitled Finding the Bodhisattva Within. Join us. And thank you to you for listening. If you enjoy our podcast, please like and share and give us a review on your favorite pod platform. Podform. Platpod? All right, it's getting silly. Time to go. Thank you for listening, everyone. May you be safe, healthy, happy, and at ease. All the best.